Oh my God, you're like listening to G'day World with Cameron Riley on the Podcast Network. Whatever.
What would you rather have, a lemon tree that's 100 feet tall and doesn't have any lemons, or a 5 foot lemon tree that's got plenty of lemons on it? I know which one I'd rather have.
Bottle of limoncello.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of which, that's what I'm making tonight. I've had my first batch.
Oh, fuck, I meant to send you that recipe. I forgot about
that.
Yeah,
you never
should have reminded me. I'm a shit bloke.
It's all right. I've got Google, mate. I've got recipes up the wazoo. I've had my first batch brewing in the cupboard for like the last week or so, the lemon peel and in just soaking in vodka, and I think it's going to be good enough. I'm going to mix up the base tonight and put it in the freezer. It'd be good.
Make sure you filter it, man. That's the one thing that I didn't do the first few times, is I didn't filter, because you get a lot of scuzz on the top. You've got to filter it. You've got to drain it through a filter.
Oh.
And the best type of filter is like some sort of a Hessian bag, or like a, not even Hessian, like a tight cotton or something like that.
I've got a fine silk bag that I usually
That's good.
I put spices in when I'm making a broth, so maybe I can filter it through.
Yeah, something like that. Because otherwise what you're going to have is you're going to have this lot of muck on the top, and you feel a bit scared to eat it, and you... or to have it. I cooked some limoncello once and didn't filter it properly, and then it went all scuzzy and I didn't like it. So just Google filtering your limoncello and you'll get a better method of what I'm telling you, but make sure you do that. Because it's a big effort to make it, you know, when you peel all your lemons and cook up your sugar and do all that, and you don't want to waste it.
I'm gonna leave that bit in the show. This is all going in the show. This is good stuff. Stephen Cam talking about limoncello recipes. So welcome back to the show, Sammartino. The Sammartino method.
Yes,
I think
I'll take it.
Fair to say that the, well, not the first show you and I did together, but the first show where we talked about the Sammartino method, very well received by folks. They really got a lot out of what you had to say about your investment methodology, as I knew they would, and so it's been pleasing. You got some? Have you had some direct feedback from folks?
I had a lot of people email me and find me through my blog and Googling me and asking me where to get started, and happily put them in the right direction.
Good stuff. Well, you know, I think it's great that we've been able to get that knowledge that you've got out there, and obviously the reason we're back today is to do a follow-up on that. Since the last time that we chatted, I was in Melbourne. When was that? Sort of October, I think, we did that show?
Yeah, even earlier. I think it might have been earlier than that. In fact, let me tell you exactly. How does this sound? I'll tell you the exact date.
It was earlier. Yeah, you're right.
No, it doesn't say it on the thing, but I can tell you it was G'day World 336.
Well, obviously, you know, what's happened since then is the world has gone into a meltdown. 336 was July, right?
There you go.
It was the 29th of July. So obviously since the 29th of July, August, September, October, November, December, a little bit over 5 months ago, the world and the markets have gone into a massive financial meltdown. And so I guess it's a good time for us to do a follow-up and talk about what does that mean? What has it meant so far to your portfolio and the sort of methodologies that you were preaching to us 5 months ago? And, you know, what changes, if any, people should be making or you will be making to your portfolio over the course of the next year, and how it's all faring? Because you know, it's one thing to be to have a healthy portfolio when times are good. I guess that's one thing. But when times are shite, as they have been at least for the markets in the last couple of months, a lot of people will be wondering what they should be doing. So,
yeah.
Is there a particular place you want to start, Steve?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is that two things. The market has been, it's been a very significant downturn. Historically, it's the biggest downturn we've had in 30 years. I think the last time we had a downturn like this was around about 1974. In fact, it was 1974. But so historically, it is a significant downturn and the most volatile market we've had in a very long time. But in terms of what I'm doing strategically, I can say that I haven't changed anything at all. I'm basically doing exactly what I was doing when we spoke 6 months ago, and nothing has changed in my strategy. Given my age, I'm 35. But in terms of the volatility, I'll just give you a couple of stats, is that usually we'll have 1 day in 100 in the share market where the market valuations will swing more than 3%. For the last 6 months, we've had on an average 1 day in 10 where the markets have swung that most. And in October, we actually had 1 in 2 days where the market went up or down by around about 3%. So it's historically more volatile than it's been since 1974. But in terms of what I'm doing, my strategy hasn't changed one bit, and all of the recommendations I'm going to give today are going to be talking about why it still makes sense to go with the strategy that I previously had. In terms of where I sit personally, the valuation of my investment asset base has gone down by nearly 50%, and it hasn't gone down by 50% because I always keep a cash component, which is currently around about 30% of my portfolio. But my equities portfolio has gone down by 50% in terms of its valuation.
And
the interesting thing is,
Does that bother you?
Sorry?
Does that bother you?
I have to convince myself every day not to worry about it and not even look. In fact, I rarely look at its valuation. The last time I looked at its valuation was, I think, on December 1st, just because I was putting some more money in. And it wasn't really to... I was just curious. I thought, I wonder how much I've gone down by here in valuation. And the reason that I'm not really worried is pretty much the same reason I said before, is that the thing that matters to me is yield, not valuation. And I was talking a little bit before about the lemon tree, and it's the same thing. I'm worried in how many eggs the investments give me, not how big the chooks are.
So why don't you explain that in English for people? Why does this drop in the valuation of your portfolio not cause you to jump out of a 40-story window?
Yeah, well, I think the one thing that... perspective on is my age, that I'm nowhere near retirement, although in real terms I'm kind of not really working for the man anyway, but it's because I'm not at a point in time where I need to live on the final valuation of what I've got. So what I'm interested in is the payments that I get, and yield is like the rent on a house. How much do you get at the end of each week for the asset that you're holding? So in this case, in share investment, it's dividend yield. So how much dividend do you get at the end of the month or the end of every 6 months when the yields go out? And that doesn't change much regardless of the valuation of a company. And I'll give you an example. Woolworths as a stock in Australia is a good example, in that people will spend pretty much the same amount on groceries in good times and in bad. And in fact, there are some arguments to say that people spend more on groceries and staple items and less on luxury items during economic downturns. So if you're holding a stock on Woolworths, although their share valuation has gone down from something like $35 to around about $23 or $24, the reality is the revenue that this company achieves won't really be that differentiated to what it was before the credit crunch hit. Now, in terms of my investing strategy, I'm not someone who holds a lot of singular stocks, but I tend to hold the top 300 stocks in Australia and the top 500 in America. And based on the fact that most of those are stable industrial companies because they're the top biggest 300 and 500, it means that the dividend yield and the earnings that these companies deliver won't vary a great deal.
Now, one of the things that we've seen happen in the last couple of months, obviously, particularly in the US, is a lot of financial institutions themselves, these companies that were managing portfolios, go belly up.
Yep.
Particularly, you know, there's been this, was it Madoff in New York? I mean, the guy who had a big fund that he managed who is up on fraud charges. I guess the first question is these companies that you have been using, I think it's Vanguard you've been using to invest with, they didn't go belly up?
No, they haven't. And I think that the probability of them going belly up is very, very low. Now, like I said last time, there is always the risk. Systematic risk is unavoidable. That is that the share market inherently has some risk, but that risk is closely associated to the civilization that we know today. So the only chance that the entire share market and everything that we know financially totally falls apart is if our civilization falls apart, in which case we'll have greater things to worry about than our bank balance. It'll be whether or not we can survive and find food and, you know, the internal wars and, you know, civil war that would ensue after that. So long as our economic system survives, then it's just the fact that the financial system that we have will survive as well. So unless we go through some sort of fall of Rome, dramatic decline, we're pretty safe. Now, in terms of Vanguard, they invest across a large number of stocks. They tend to buy the market rather than pick and choose. So the example that I think of is And I've lost some money in stocks just recently. I actually held some shares in ABC Learning, so I'm not perfect and I lose money from time to time in investing, but that's part and parcel of the game. But the example is, if I hold 300 stocks in Australia, which I do through Vanguard, ABC Learning is one of those stocks that was in the top 300. Now, that stock's disappeared. It's off the market, okay? So I can count that that money's been lost. So when we invest in the index, that means that that's a 1 in 300th loss that we've got, or 1 in 500th if you're holding the US stocks, and a Lehman Brothers is in the top 500 US stocks. So what that means is you've got the 490 others that didn't go bust to hold up your portfolio valuation, and you've got new stocks that will come into that. So you can lose money, but you're avoiding unsystematic risk. And unsystematic risk is when you pick stocks and try and beat the market. So if I hold a whole lot of stock in ABC Learning and Lehman Brothers and they go bust, I've basically, that's unsystematic risk that's got me. But the systematic risk of holding 500 stocks or holding 300 stocks in Australia or investing in the entire share market means that, you know, if we hear about 4 or 5 stocks that go bust, it's only going to be 4 in 300 or, you know, 1 in 500 that we lose. So the good in there, it's, you know, it's like one bad apple within the lot. We can throw that away and still know that we've got our full yield there. So that's why indexing in this time is actually an even better strategy than it is in good times. In good times, there's a chance that your investment won't return as much. It'll be a little bit below some of the greater funds that do well, or people that pick stocks and get lucky. But in bad times, it means that it's very hard to lose all of your money.
So if you have companies in the top 300 and they start to perform poorly, don't they get taken out of the index that you're investing in at some stage?
Yeah, they recalibrate around about every quarter, from what I understand. So at the end of every quarter, they'll buy and sell stocks based on their position in the top 300 upweight or downweight stocks. So chances are, when a stock starts to perform very poorly, I think that ABC fell out of the index when it got to around about $2. So if you're holding that entire stock, you lost all your money. If you're in an index, it falls out at 1.2. So there's a little bit of protection, because where it sits in the index is based on its valuation. And as that share price drops, then that provides you with a little bit of protection. It's almost like a stop loss situation. When it gets down to a certain value, it'll be sold out anyway. So it affords you some protection in that way as well.
So I remember when you were on last time, you were explaining, as you mentioned earlier on, that really what you're looking for from your portfolio isn't necessarily the cap valuation of the portfolio, it's the dividends. In difficult financial times, do companies stop paying dividends? What happens to that income stream from dividends that you were relying on?
Yeah, what they tend to do is they usually retain more earnings, okay? So the dividends rates will usually drop. So if they're paying 5%, they might pull it down to 3%. Let's say, I'm just throwing numbers out there. But the reality is that most earnings don't really change a great deal. There's always a level of up and down within earnings, but they tend to retain earnings. And then when the sun starts shining again, that money is usually forwarded onto the investors when they're a little bit more confident. They tend to cut back on advertising and cut heads and cut jobs. But in fact, a lot of the time when we hear about companies, ANZ is a current example where they've talked about cutting 3,000 jobs. Because the market is down, they use it as an opportunity to cut heads. I mean, this is what they do. It's a way when they can recalibrate their balance sheet and get rid of some excess fat because the market accepts it. The reality may be, I mean, ANZ is earning billion-dollar profits. I'm sure they can hang on to the 3,000 people. But in bad times, it actually gives them a chance to recalibrate their balance sheet and, you know, get rid of people, for want of a better word, and restructure their organisation so that when the sun shines again, the returns will even be higher. So although we may not receive a yield that is as high, holding on to those stocks over that long-term period will mean that the yields really don't change a great deal. It's more the way the balance sheet is managed during tough times. People tighten up and companies tighten up, but the reality is most of the income is usually still there. And in fact, some companies actually make more profits in these terms, and they tend to be the larger conglomerates that make up a large part of the index. Companies like, you know, cash flow companies like, you know, Foster's Brewing and the banks and Woolworths and these types of companies. So although the yields might go down, the earnings usually don't change a great deal.
So what's your strategy for, you know, the next 6 to 12 months now? Are you holding firm with what you were telling us 5 months ago?
Yeah, in fact, I haven't changed one bit. I still invest the same amount every month out of my cash and into the index fund. I'm still doing 50% on the top 500 US stocks and 50% on the top 300 Australian stocks through Vanguard. In fact, I'm actually really happy, and this is what I have to convince myself in the tough times, is that because the asset valuation has gone down by 5%, what this means is that every time I buy, let's say, $1,000 worth of stock, that's like I was investing $2,000 worth of stock when we spoke about it 6 months ago. Every time I get a dividend of 5% and reinvest those dividends in more stocks, that's like I'm reinvesting 10%. And because I'm at a young age, this is really just an amazing buying opportunity. It's kind of weird. When we go to the supermarket and we see Coca-Cola on sale for 99 cents, we buy more. But when we're thinking of the share market, when we see the shares go down and come down at a discount, we buy less, which is kind of weird. So to me, it's a buying opportunity. And although you can look at the raw numbers of your capital valuation, it's actually an incredible time for anyone to invest. So if there's any young people out there just starting in their job or well before the age of retirement, there, in fact, these opportunities have really only come around about four times in the last 100 years where stocks are valued as they are now, and there's good opportunities, buying opportunities to get in. So if anything, this is something smiling upon me to give me the opportunity to buy shares at a really cheap price at the moment. So it's a good time to upweight your investment if you're not at the age of retirement. Because if you are at the age of retirement, that changes things a lot. And in fact, that was one of the things I wanted to talk about, is that I think when you get older, your strategy needs to be very different from a younger person. And what you need to focus on is moving some of your assets from equity to cash and property, which have a more consistent, the yields tend to be the same. Property valuations tend not to go up and down as much if you're not too speculative with your purchases, simply because there's not a quotation on what that property's worth every day. There's not someone in the market telling you what you can buy and sell that property for. So you need to increase your cash and property holdings as you get, within the last 10 years of your working life. And I've said before that, property and shares are really, I don't view them as different assets. I don't think one has a necessary advantage over the other. But property has a stability advantage in that, an investment property or a portfolio of investment properties, the valuation on that doesn't fluctuate as much because it's not quoted on the stock market.
All right. Well, I'm guessing most people listening to this aren't going to be near retirement age, and if they are, go out. Guess
they are. Yeah, we can be sure to ask us any questions. But if you are near the retirement age, your strategy does need to change a little bit. Yeah.
Which, and the retirement age here, we're talking about 33, right?
For me, although I'm not really retired, I call it opportunity. I kind of got myself into an opportunity space where I can spend my days how I please rather than doing something else someone tells me to do.
So getting back to what you were saying before about this being a good opportunity, so if I understand correctly what you're saying, it's whereas 6 months ago a particular share might have cost you $2, now you can buy it for $1.
That's exactly it, and
the dividend earning potential of that share, you're saying on average across the portfolio hasn't weakened substantially, at least in the long term. So it's actually, you're picking up this stuff at half price.
In fact, let me give you some of the good news while we're on that. Not only is the price cheaper, but here's some of the things that the credit crunch has enabled in terms of investing. And assuming that most of the people listening are well below retirement age, what we've got is lower interest rates now. We've got lower commodity prices, which basically go into everything that these companies make, buy and sell, regardless of whether they're selling beer or stuff out of the ground or building buildings. So lower commodity prices. We've got dividend yields, which are far more attractive and have a historical advantage in terms of where they're at. We've got dividend yields on banks that are around about 8 or 9% before tax franking, which means it's before any tax advantage is taken into account. And we've got price earnings ratios, which are now around about 15 times price earnings ratios, 10 to 15 versus about 25 where they were before. So the average return after all this is that there's a lot more good news in there now post credit crunch than there was in July in real terms. So it's actually a better time to be investing, and it's certainly not a time to change the strategy. If anything, it's time to relook and say the original strategy is as good now, as good as it ever was. And, you know, in order to take advantage of an up market, you need to be prepared to be in one in a down market. So a lot of people think we only hear about the share market when times are good in the newspapers and everyone's talking about investing. But you really don't benefit from an upturn in a market unless you're in there when it's down. And there's no one who can pick the bottom of the market or the top of the market. So we know that it's low now, and if you're in it for the long term,
except Kerry Packer,
it's a very good time to get in.
Except Kerry Packer, mate. Kerry always got out at the top.
That's true. A lot of people bagged James Packer when he sold off the PBL, but that's now valued at 50% less than when he sold it. So,
you've got
the Midas touch there. It must be something in the Packer blood.
Well, no, it's not the Packer blood. It's in the Packer, the advisors of the Packers have already surrounded themselves, mate. They surround themselves with the smart people. I said at the time when Packer sold out, it's because he knows the TV's dead, mate. He wasn't, I don't know if he knew the global financial crisis was coming, but he certainly knew the TV and magazine industry crisis was coming, and you didn't have to be a rocket scientist to know that. I want to ask you about the media, though. I don't read newspapers or watch TV or listen to radio, but, I scan the online headlines every morning for 30 seconds just to see if, you know, any buildings have blown up or countries have gone to war or whatever. But the mainstream media in this country, in the US, from what I can gather, there's a fair amount of doom and gloom happening around this kind of stuff, but that doesn't seem to be your perspective. I mean, why do you think the media is so dark on the whole thing?
You know, I actually think that the media have got two defaults. They either have irrational exuberance or irrational pessimism, because that's what sells newspapers. They want people to live in fear. This is my personal, I guess, political opinion. I believe that what they want to do is have people in fear that they're going to lose their pants, or in fear that they're missing out on the good times while everyone else is getting rich and they're just driving in their car to their job. So the thing that sells newspapers is the extreme either way. Either times are extremely good, get in or miss out, or times are extremely bad, you know, batten down the hatches, because they need to sensationalise things to get people interested. And so what we find ensues is irrational overvaluations and irrational pessimism. And at the moment, we're going through irrational pessimism just 12 months after we had the opposite, which makes me think that the reality is somewhere in the middle. It always is. And, that's what sells newspapers. So in a way, you almost need to ignore it. And I spoke about ignoring what's in the newspaper again. And I'll just give you an example. If we take from 1971 until now and look at the average return of both dividend and capital valuation in the Australian share market, even after this credit crunch, it averages out at 13.1%. That's 1971 until today, okay? And if we go back from about 1930 until today, the average return is still about 13.1%. And the reason that the market has downturned quite a bit is that we've basically had an irrational response to the valuations of assets and shares in the last few years. So in 2004, the Australian share market returned 22%, remembering that the average return is 13%. In 2005, it returned 24.7%. In 2006, it returned 24.2%. And in 2007, it returned 30.3%. So what we had was, if you add up all of those returns, it comes out to 101. And if you average out 13.1% over 5 years, that would have been a 65% return. So we've had the assets valued at around about 35% overvalued to what the historical return is on share markets. Now, if we take away that 35% from the 101, it means that we've sold down the market to around about 50%. So basically, they've oversold. But really, the valuation of the market, if we take 100 as what it was for the last 4 years, it really should have been about 65, but they've sold it down to about 50. So the return that we've had, the downturn in the market now, is really just recalibrating the market to where it should be, to the long-term averages, which are around about 13%. And if we've had plus 20% over the last 5 years, so all the market's doing is kind of readjusting itself. And in terms of where the media's at and where people behave, the return should be 35% lower than what it was, but they've oversold it by kind of 50%. So we already know that in the long-term valuation that the market is undervalued and people are being too pessimistic.
Where do you get all this data from, Steve? You're rattling off all these numbers.
Well, I'm not going to lie. I did do a little bit of homework just before we were chatting, mainly because I thought people will if I don't provide some of the numbers, people ask you a lot of questions on the back end. I thought I'll throw them up. But you know what? It is ridiculously easy to get all of this data. I mean, if you just Googled in, you know, price earnings ratio of Australian's share market or average returns, there are so many websites. I'm not even going to name what they are because it's just so easy to go to Google and just say, what's the average return in the Australian share market? You know, what would $10,000 invested in a 970 be worth today? All of this stuff is really easy. I got most of it off Vanguard because they're who I invest through and they've got a whole lot of tools. In fact, I can send you a link through to that where all of these tools are, where you can put in all the different data that spits it all out. But this information is available to anyone with a laptop and a broadband cable. And interestingly, you know, we can circumvent all the bullcrap that we're told in newspapers by actually doing your own homework. Don't waste half an hour watching Channel 9. Spend half an hour on Google and some of the finance pages, and you don't need any doom and gloom commentary. You can just read them and interpret the data yourself. So we're kind of, you know, like we are with media, where we can circumvent all the bullshit we hear about what's happening in the Middle East and find out the real story through, you know, places like the podcast network and what have you. We can do the same with finances. We're at an age now where we can get the truth pretty quick if we want to dig around instead of just being, you know, passive receivers of information and someone else's opinion.
You mentioned price earnings ratios for those of us that don't live and breathe this stuff. Do you want to give us a little bit of a refresher on what a PE ratio is and why it matters?
Yeah, a price earnings ratio is what the return is for a company based on how much it would cost you to buy that share. So if a share is worth $1 and it's returning 10 cents per year, its price earnings ratio would be 10 times. So in 10 years, you could pay back the cost of buying that stock. Okay, if it was a 5% return on that $1 stock, that would be a 20 times price earnings ratio. So it's simply the value of the stock divided by the yield or the earnings of that company.
And why does it matter? What does it tell you?
Yeah, what it tells you is how cheap or expensive the stock is. If the stock is got a very high price earnings ratio, it means it's off that original investment, and it means that your yields are low. So it's kind of almost like how many lemons you're going to get off the tree. So the lower the price earnings ratio, the greater earnings to valuation you've got, the cheaper the stock is. So a stock that's giving you 50 cents in dividends a year to a valuation of $1, that would be a 2x price earnings ratio, which would be incredibly cheap. And the reason that it matters is it gives you an indication of the stock on whether it's an expensive or a cheap stock. And of course, dividend yields, it's a little bit more complex than that. There's a whole lot of things that come into it, like the probability of the earnings to increase, or if people feel that a company is highly risky or highly leveraged, its price earnings ratio might drop because people are fearful that that's unsustainable. So mining stocks sometimes have really high price earnings ratios because they feel that it's a very cyclical market. So there's a little bit more to it, but the basics of a price earnings ratio is how many years it would take you to pay back that stock when you bought it based on its earnings.
Now, hold on a minute. The last time we got together and did this show, you were saying this is easy stuff. You just buy these Vanguard index funds. Do people need to know all this stuff if they're just buying the index fund?
I'm kind of explaining the background. You know what? You really don't need to know anything, actually. And if I was to give the same advice, this is the advice I'd give. And it's funny, I've got a couple of guys who are working with me on Rentoid who I'm saying to these guys in a mentoring fashion, get your investment strategy right now. If I wish I had started when you started. I started in my mid-20s and still did okay, but I'm telling these 21-year-olds, get it going. And here's what I'm telling them. I'm saying for every dollar you earn, put 30 cents of that dollar into a high interest bearing deposit account in an Australian bank, so it's protected, which is what anyone should do. You really should be with a large bank that, you know, is government guaranteed. So I would put it in a high interest bearing deposit account and on call. I would have it on call, and I would put that 30 cents in the dollar in there every single pay. Every dollar that goes through my hands, I would put in there and not even think about it. Once it gets up to a certain level, around about $5,000, I would invest in an index fund. I would invest half of it in overseas stocks and half of it in local stocks. And I would keep 10% in that account, and I would put 20% of that $1 that I've earned, 10 into the local Australian fund and 10 into the international fund. If I was in Australia, I'd do it through Vanguard. If I was in the US, or the UK, I'd do it through. If I was in the US, I'd do it through Vanguard. If I was in the UK, I'd do it through Fidelity. And I think we had a link to that on the last one. And I would put that money straight into the Vanguard and put a fixed amount in every month and not even look at what the prices are. And I would reinvest all of my dividends and continue to do that once a month in perpetuity. That's still the same advice that I'd give. You really don't need to know a lot about it because of all the reasons that I've described. You avoid unsystematic risk. You get all of the stocks. You get the good ones. The bad ones drop out. You know that you know over the long term, you're going to get around about a 13% return, which compounded can make anyone incredibly rich. And that is still what I'd do today.
And the risk, I know we started with this, but the risk in buying Vanguard Fund, if Vanguard did go belly up, do you lose everything or do you still have the shares actually in your name, the certificates?
I believe that you still have the shares in your name. I'll need to check up on some of that. That's how risk averse I am. But no, I believe that you would still have the shares in your name because they hold them on behalf of you. So the stocks that they hold are on your behalf.
Because quite frankly, my level of trust in these big financial institutions to manage their own businesses isn't very high.
We've
seen a lot of them doing a lot of fucking crazy, stupid stuff.
Yeah, I think that, again, a lot of that's been sold through the media because we've seen hedge funds fall over, funds with, you know, very complex derivatives and all sorts of financial instruments, which have what has caught out the companies. The thing with something like Vanguard is that they invest in the top 300 stocks. They've got other funds, but that's really, you know, 90% of what they do. They're a very conservative organisation. They're not an aggressive fund manager. They never ever win the highest returns in any market, and they never get the lowest returns. But what they get is predictable returns over the long run. Like I said, the risk in the market is the same as the risk of our civilization falling apart. And that can happen. It's happened, you know, in the history of man, and it could happen. But in terms of, you know, the lifestyle that we live today in cities and how financially set up we are, the only risk in this organisation falling over is the risk that our general society falls over because the way they almost, it's really like an investment in society, if that makes sense, because all of the large corporations that they invest in are the ones that we use and eat and drive and, you know, all of that stuff put together. So there is risk, and that's unavoidable. If you want to invest and get some benefits of investing in a share market or a property market or anything, then you need to accept that there's certain risk in life and there's certain systematic risk, and that goes with that. But as far as them being a cowboy organisation or something that's, or an organisation that's taken a large amount of risk, I think they're more conservative than most of the fund managers.
Tell us a little bit more about this book that you're writing, mate.
Yeah, I'm writing a book called The Nature of Business. I've already written parts of it, and some of it's appeared in my blog. But basically, it's about nature and how most things that we see in business are actually replicated in nature. Every now and again, what we do is we basically think that we're a little bit cleverer than nature, and we'll try and beat it and do things like try and beat the yield of nature, even in crops at a very basic level. We'll put more fertilizer in there than we need to and not give the crops a rest and let the paddock lay for one year in five and do a whole lot of stuff. But nature always comes back and wins. And my viewpoint is that if in life, in society and in business, we looked at how nature approaches things, we would certainly be better off both as people and as a civilization. So I'm writing about the analogies with nature and business and how they're inextricably linked, and that if we look to the answers in nature and how nature does things, we'd be far more successful in our business and personal lives.
You ever read a book by Jim Rohn called The Seasons of Life?
I haven't, but you did tell me about it once, and I probably should get a copy of it, yeah.
Yeah, very. I remember reading that when I was like in my early 20s, and very similar sort of philosophy at a higher level, and it's stuck with me ever since. You know, this idea that life goes in seasons, and yet you have your good time, you have your summer where everything's cooking, and then you have your winter where everything's dark and dismal, and then you have, you know, sort of autumn and spring in between that, and you know, you can't, you know, wish that the seasons didn't happen. They're going to happen, and you just need to be prepared for each season. You know,
yeah, you need to accept. It's funny because my father, he's an Italian farmer. There's a lot of things now that, as I'm getting older, I used to think he was crazy and I was too busy off drinking beers and chasing girls to listen to him. But as I get older, I spend a lot more time kicking the dirt with him out on the farm and talking. And a lot of things he said to me when he was quite young just seem to make so much sense now. Things like, you know, growing vegetables and cooking food and understanding the way nature works. And he's strange. He talks to his animals and even his chooks. And you know, he always said to me, Steve, you've got to eat the eggs, live on the eggs and never, ever eat the chook. He said, and every now and again, you let an egg hatch, so you've got another chook, and you manage it, and you care after your animals, and you look after your property, and you talk to your plants, and it's crazy. I mean, I'm only really scratching the surface on some of the things that he says, but it's just some values that I think we've lost as a society in the last kind of 30 years, and some of the things he's saying are really starting to just make sense now. And I think for all the good things that the Industrial Revolution brought us, like the internet and computers and so on, it kind of made us lose touch with the things that sustain life and relationships and working reasonable hours. And, you know, I think I did hear a statistic somewhere that it was before the Industrial Revolution, the average working hours was 5 hours a day. And, you know, for all the flat screen TVs we've got, I think we've got something terribly wrong. And we've got society of people who don't know where their food comes from or how to cook and all of these things. And I just think that there might be something good in getting back to nature a little bit and looking at those answers. So, and hopefully now, you know, with the net, we're all starting to connect. And I think we were talking about before sharing recipe ideas over Twitter and whatever it is, we're all kind of starting to get re-in touch with, you know, society and nature. So that's kind of, my dad's kind of put me down that track and I just can't stop thinking about it now.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I guess one of the things that I think about a lot as a father is how to help my kids appreciate some of that stuff so they don't grow up as, you know, urbanite little brats that know nothing about, you know, the nature of the seasons of life. I remember my dad, growing up in country Queensland, had a big veggie patch in the backyard. And so at least we got to eat, you know, fresh vegetables and some fresh fruit. But, you know, I've never had a backyard big enough to, you know, grow. I've got a herb garden in my little, you know, inner city unit here, but certainly not a big veggie patch. You miss out a lot of that stuff. And you're not in touch with where this sort of stuff comes from. And, you know, you and I were talking earlier about cooking and how everyone lately on Twitter has been talking about what they're cooking and what they're making. And I've got a young guy in Brisbane on Twitter, Prest Starling, who just wrote 5 minutes ago, you know, your food photos make me want to actually cook for myself now. Good job. So it works.
Yeah, simple ingredients too. I mean, that's the thing. You know, I grow I haven't got a big backyard either at the moment, although all my relatives have big, I call them wog gardens. I'm allowed to say that because I'm a teen, but I have a few pots out the back growing some Roma tomatoes and basil, and I just go outside and pick off some basil and throw it in the pasta. I can't describe how it makes me feel. It makes me feel better than any financial numbers in a bank account or other things that I've done make me feel. Just to kind of get at one with nature, grow something and eat it, it's just, I don't know, it just brings you in touch with stuff. And it's kind of not that hard, but it's so rewarding. And it's really generous. The interesting thing about nature is that it's just so damn generous. You put some stuff in the dirt, water it a little bit, come and talk to it every now and again and nurture it, maybe stake it a little bit and pull off some bad leaves and flick off some bugs, and it gives you this amazing yield. I mean, we live in such a generous ecosystem, and yet most people I know want to earn more money and want to do more and have a bigger house. Maybe they should grow some tomatoes and just see how generous the real important things are in nature.
Steve Sammartino of the Sammartino Method. Words of wisdom, mate, just flowing tonight. You're in the zone.
You bring it out of me, Cam. You bring out the best in me.
This father of yours didn't happen to share with you a ancient Italian Sammartino family limoncello recipe that you're going to pass on to me yet, did he?
I have got one, and I need to... actually, my uncle's got a great one, so I will find that out for you this week, and we should really post it on the G'day World blog as well, I think, to share it with everyone.
Absolutely. Cheers, mate. Thanks for taking the time to come on and chat with us again.
You're welcome. Anytime.
And give people the URL for both your blog and also, of course, the Rentoid blog. We haven't even really mentioned Rentoid at all on the show.
No,
but of course, people who've listened to the first show and will know that you're the CEO of Rentoid.com, renting stuff online. That's not actually your official tagline. Do you have a tagline?
Yeah, our tagline is the place to rent anything.
That was close enough.
So it's Rentoid.com, Rentoid.com. And my blog is Startup Blog, which is startupblog.wordpress.com. startuplogin.com. But I think if you type in startup login to Google, it's pretty much number one. Well, I'm sure it is. Last time I checked, it was. So I blog pretty much every day, and you can always get me on Rentoid. I'm on Skype, and I've got a little bubble there that says when I'm live online. So if you ever want to have a chat to me, feel free to just say good day.
You've got a little bubble.
I've got a little bubble that says Steve's online in the contact page on Rentoid.com.
Beautiful. Good on you, mate. Thanks for the chat.
Thanks very much.